Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Florida ties to the 1st Black Regiment in the Civil War.
It's just very exciting. I don't think we'll be able to look at the conflict the same way ever again.
We'll discuss the origin of Fellsmere in Indian River County.
In 1910, Fell bought 118,000 acres for $1.35 an acre in Indian River County.
And we'll talk about an early automobile road trip. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The 108th Annual Conference of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History will be held September 20th through 24th at the Hyatt Regency in Jacksonville. One of the presenters will be Wyatt Urchak, discussing Florida ties to the 1st Black Regiment in the Civil War. Holly Baker has more.
Wyatt Urchak is a PhD candidate at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he studies 19th century American history, slavery, revolution, and warfare across the Atlantic world. He talked with me about his mission to uncover the story of the 1st Black Regiment organized by the Union Army during the Civil War.
The subtitle of my project is A Hidden History, because so much of this is simply not known. In fact, the history of this regiment has really been defined for over 150 years by the writings of a very small number of white officers. The colonel, for example, wrote a memoir very soon after the Civil War, and that still remains the foundation for the stories that are told about this regiment and what's been known. That constitutes the ground, let's say, of the stories that have been told about this regiment. There's been a couple books, but not much at all. So my mission has been to go below the ground. What's the subterranean history here? Hence the hidden history. So you have to dig and dig and dig.
In November of 1862, Colonel Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a white officer, assumed command of the 1st Black Regiment, the 1st South Carolina Volunteer Infantry, and led them on an expedition up the St. Mary's River along the Florida-Georgia line. One of the most significant actions they took part in was the occupation of Jacksonville in March of 1863, which met no resistance. Colonel Higginson wrote in his 1869 book, Army Life in a Black Regiment, that the 1st South Carolina Volunteer Infantry was the 1st Black Regiment, quote, that ever bore arms in defense of freedom on the continent of America. The regiment formed in Hilton Head, South Carolina, in May of 1862, a year before other black units formed or even began recruiting. Congress passed the Militia Act of 1862 in July, authorizing black armed service. The 54th Massachusetts, the black regiment depicted in the 1989 film Glory, didn't start recruiting until February of 1863. While researching the hidden history of the regiment, Wyatt Urchak discovered the story of a formerly enslaved soldier from Jacksonville named Ned. Materials held in the Library of Florida History in Cocoa offered Wyatt some clues about Ned's life.
There's so many stories I could choose. First, Ned. When I came to the archives where we met, I was on the search for someone named Ned that an enslaver based along the St. John's River and in Jacksonville named David Palmer said escaped from him in March 1862. And I was intrigued when I came upon that claim for a loss. It was basically a claim to the Confederate authorities for property losses with the hopes that he might be reimbursed. when I came upon that, bells immediately started ringing because I realized that one of the soldiers in the regiment was named Edward. And in his record, it was noted that he had been enslaved by David Palmer. And I thought, Edward, Ned, could it be the same person? Because in slavery, people weren't often given full names. They were often known by diminutive and demeaning nicknames like Ned or Jim or Bob or Bessie or Janie. Once people emancipated themselves, they often renamed themselves. So Ned became Edward, Bob became Robert. Sometimes it's completely gone, that former name. So I thought the age is about right. The name is similar. I've encountered other instances where that diminutive is in fact the same soldier down the line.
Union-occupied Jacksonville became a magnet for escaped slaves who were then recruited as soldiers. Records indicate that after Ned, or Edward, escaped from David Palmer, he enlisted with the Union Army and became part of the 1st Black Regiment.
And what was extraordinary about this case was Ned escapes in March 1862, according to Palmer's claim, followed by almost every single month an increasing number of people escaping from enslavement by Palmer. So Ned is like the first into the breach, if you will. And then exactly 1 year later, in March of 1863, the 1st Black Regiment, along with others from the Union Army, returns to Jacksonville. And this is where the colonel says many of the men who had been from Florida, from Jacksonville, had, quote, private wrongs to avenge there. So I said, wow, if that's Edward, Edward is with that returning party. And all sorts of things happen that might constitute the justice that I had mentioned before, where people return to these sites and sometimes destroy them completely, sometimes just present themselves as dignified human beings that you must respect, partially because, hey, I've got a gun now, I've got a name now, and you need to treat me the way that you should have treated me as a human being with full rights and so on. So that's what I was looking for. Is Ned somewhere in Palmer's papers? And I did find Ned. I found him in several places. And I'm still sifting through the when, the where, and the how, and whether I could place him at various spots. But Ned is also noted as a woodcutter and a pilot on the St. John's River, as enslaved by Palmer. So he would have been cutting wood, live oak, and transporting it on the river for Palmer. And those skills were often put to use in the army as well. And as a pilot on the river, he would have intelligence. He would know where to go. I can see him being the leader who is feeding command intelligence for this Jacksonville operation. And that story is one that I hope to highlight.
The men from the 1st South Carolina Volunteer Regiment often fought in the same locations where they were enslaved. In acts of resistance, some returning soldiers appropriated property or committed acts of destruction. As Wyatt Urchak explains, these actions could be seen as forms of justice.
In the case of the Black Regiment that I'm studying, several of those individuals escaped, enlisted, and when they returned to their former site of enslavement, they had the power of the U.S. military with them. And so sometimes these become extraordinarily large-scale acts of justice for slavery. Now, you can't always get into personal motivation because we don't always have those sources, but you can connect those dots and suggest that for someone who had been enslaved in this place to take possession of it, for example, to confront their former enslaver in uniform with a gun, with a new name often, these can't just be seen in the abstract. They have to be interpreted in their specific context, in their personal context, in terms of that person's life story and this sort of arc of justice that that represents, in my argument. So I will be highlighting a few case studies that I think illustrate this type of paradigm that the Civil War in northeastern Florida, in coastal Georgia, in South Carolina, which I see as one large borderland. The regiment itself was composed of roughly 50% people originating in South Carolina, mostly along the coast. But then the other 50% are just about evenly split between Georgia and Florida. So there's a lot of Florida stories tied up in this, and we don't know a lot about them because South Carolina and Virginia, states like that, tend to get much more attention, not just in Civil War history, but Southern history in general. So part of what I'm trying to do is highlight some of those stories as well.
These stories show that there's still much to be learned about the Civil War and the men in the Black regiments who took up arms to end slavery. Wyatt Urchak.
You know, the 1st Black Regiment is really a great way to focus our attention on paths not taken and sort of people that we don't know, people that we don't celebrate, and asking ourselves, why not? Why did we make that choice instead of this one? So that's at the heart, I think, of the research that I'm pursuing. We have barely scratched the surface of the intersecting stories that a regiment like this can help us to understand, but all of them are buried and hidden. That's the most remarkable thing. So despite being the single most written about subject in American history, there is so much somehow still and almost entirely unknown about the Civil War and the types of civil wars that were being fought by different kinds of regiments. So these Florida stories really help to highlight those other elements. And it's just very exciting because I don't think we'll be able to look at the conflict the same way ever again once we start to uncover these things. And my hope would be the research that I'm pursuing provokes many other efforts to take another look. If you have a regiment whose soldiers have been, almost all of them, enslaved in the same locations that they're operating in, and they're fighting Confederate forces that were often the very same people that enslaved them, do we really understand that story? I don't think so. I think there's a lot more work to be done. And I think that once that work really starts to build upon itself, as I hope that it will, we just won't be able to look at the Civil War the same way ever again. And that can help us in the conversations that we're having today in the state of Florida in general, in terms of education, in terms of books that are banned, things we can and can't say, and on a national level, whether it's monuments, whether it's celebrations, memorials, all sorts of topics. So it's a very important effort, and Florida is right at the heart of it.
Wyatt Urchak will be discussing his research at the 108th Annual Conference of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History in Jacksonville in September. His presentation is called Ned, Who Thus Became Lost, Running Off and Returning with a Vengeance in the Swamplands of the Civil War. To learn more about the conference, go to asalh.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch archived episodes of our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Fellsmere is an interesting little town in Indian River County that is remembered in history as the site where Zena Dreyer is said to be the first woman to cast a ballot in a Florida election in 1915, 4 years before the 19th Amendment.
That's correct, but in a 1997 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly, Gordon Patterson argued that Fellsmere should be remembered for its origin story that also engaged state, national, and international history. Titled Ditches and Dreams, Nelson Fell and the Rise of Fellsmere, Patterson's article draws from Florida's environmental history, global economic changes and British imperialism to explain the creation of Fellsmere in the early 20th century. Nelson Fell, born in New Zealand in 1857 and educated in the best English and German schools and universities, was, as Patterson described him, an itinerant Englishman and hydraulic engineer. He was also the youngest of six sons and therefore unlikely to inherit any part of his father's substantial fortune. Twice he moved to Central Florida, first at the instigation of his brother Arthur in the 1880s, and again with the support of his family in 1911, for what he believed to be opportunity to put his stamp on the area's development and make a lot of money.
Connie, two moves to Florida suggests that the first endeavor did not go according to plan.
No, it did not. Nelson Fell was among a number of younger sons of successful British businessmen who saw insufficient opportunity for their own prospects at home and migrated to the United States in the 1870s and 1880s. You can find these English colonies in several southern states. In her Centennial History of Orlando, Eve Bacon notes that these men were lured by advertisements placed in pamphlets and sporting magazines that promised cheap land, warm climate, and profits from land development and citrus production. For the landed gentry of England with more sons than wealth, it seemed, quote, a golden opportunity to quietly dispose of second sons by pensioning them off in Florida. With the help of his brother, Fell created the Florida Land and Mortgage Company and purchased 12,000 acres of land, reserving 2,000 acres for a town he would call Narcoosi, an indigenous word for bear. He began dividing the remaining land into small farms of 2 to 10 acres. In 1888, Narcoosi was home to some 200 English settlers and had a post office, a railroad station, and steamboat services to St. Cloud and Kissimmee. If the future seemed bright in 1888, it quickly dimmed in the 1890s. The boom of the 80s became the economic decline of the 90s that finally produced the Panic of 1893 and the resulting depression that was the worst economic depression in American history until the Great Depression of the 1930s. In Florida, the back-to-back freezes of 1894-1895 destroyed citrus trees. The citrus industry would not return to earlier production levels for the next decade. Finally, the mid-1890s was not a good time to be an Englishman in the United States. A decades-long dispute over the boundary between Venezuela and British New Guinea drew the United States and the UK into a diplomatic confrontation. Taken together with the other adverse events, a number of English immigrants, including Fell, returned to England. Shortly after his return, Fell left for Siberia and then Central Asia, where he made his fortune in mining.
Connie, having made his fortune elsewhere, why did Fell return to Florida?
Fell returned to the United States in 1909, a rich man, and bought an estate in Virginia. In the early 20th century, Florida was again a place with tremendous opportunities for development. The cohort of men previously engaged in the Narcoosi land scheme were ready to try again, and Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Boward was in the drainage business on behalf of the state. In 1910, Fell bought 118,000 acres for $1.35 an acre in Indian River County and called the planned project the Fellsmere Farm Company. The hydraulic engineer recognized the importance of creating a long-term drainage plan. He hired Ernest Every as project manager and J.G. White Company to develop a plan to drain the area using a series of canals that would ultimately drain into the Sebastian River. Work began in 1911 and employed 175 men. A Chattanooga, Tennessee firm, Securities Underwriters Corporation, handled the land sales, and by 1913, Fellsmere had a population of 600 with a bank, a farmer's fraternity, and a newspaper called the Fellsmere Farmer. At that point, things fell apart again, and like the previous venture, the problems were both internal and external. Scandal in the Everglades drainage venture undermined land sales for all projects in Florida. The $1 million set aside for the Fellsmere drainage was not enough, and in 1914 the company was forced to reorganize. Finally, the outbreak of World War I in August 1914 dried up land sales. As Patterson explained, land sales had practically ceased, collections were falling, and most importantly, recent heavy rains presented unanticipated new problems. The initial drainage program was inadequate to the task of draining all of the company's lands. The company retrenched, reduced the drainage area from the original 454 square miles, and constructed a levee to protect the drained area, but it was of no use. Heavy rains in 1915 again wiped out many farms, and although the company replaced 4,647 citrus trees destroyed by the downpour, the company could not survive. Although Nelson Fell remained popular with the community, the project fell into receivership in 1916. He left Fellsmere in 1917 for his estate in Virginia, where he died in 1928. As Patterson concluded, like the Narcoosee colony before it, Fellsmere Farms Company did not flourish. The technological challenge of draining the headwaters of the St. Johns proved too great. Still, Fell and his confederates accomplished much in the face of tremendous obstacles, and despite their financial losses, they laid the foundations for a progressive community that aspired to be a bright spot in the South.
Well, thanks to Nelson Fell for bringing us Fellsmere, and thank you, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at an early automobile road trip.
Dr. Martin T. Olaf is a professor of history at Troy University Dothan campus and director of the Wiregrass Archives in Troy, Alabama. He has written and published books and journal articles on the Good Roads Movement and pathfinding trips. I spoke with him about his journal article in the winter/spring 2021 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly titled Pathfinders, Progressives, and Boosters, the 1911 Gulf to Great Lakes as the Crow Flies Automobile Adventure. This automobile adventure featured Dr. S.R. Mallory Kennedy, a physician, well-known automobilist, and well-liked Pensacola booster, Frank L. Mays, a prominent Pensacola Journal editor who wrote and published about the adventure as it played out, and A.M. Avery Jr. and F.C. Brent Jr., two prominent businessmen in Pensacola. As Dr. Olaf explained, this was much more significant than going on a risky road trip. This was to attract tourists from the Midwest and the North to Pensacola and the broader Gulf region.
This was, like I said in the article title, it was an adventure. And the point was to drive on the absolutely worst roads imaginable, things you would not walk on, they drove on from Pensacola to Chicago. And the overriding idea here was what you might think of as open a route from Chicago, where all the tourists were, to Pensacola, where the Commercial Association wanted these tourists to come and spend their money.
This adventure was multifaceted, as seen in the article's title. It was an amalgam of who these four men were, the attitudes and conditions of the era, and their overall goals and expectations that were set for this trip. From pathfinders to progressives to the fun nickname as the crow flies, and boosters, Dr. Olaf explained it all.
When we say pathfinding trip, there was an era from about 1905 through, it kept going, but after about 1915, it really kind of stopped, of quote-unquote pathfinders. And these guys were all over the place. Cars became reliable. And so instead of testing the reliability of cars, they were promoting good roads and the creation of roadways, long distance roadways, highways we would call them, as competition to long distance train travel. That was to them the future. my argument is, in my book and somewhat in this article, is that these progressives that were involved in the Good Roads Movement not only wanted to hem in the working class or absorb the working class, but also wanted to offer alternatives to things that were controlled by either of these other groups. And railroads was a big one. Highways and cars, not railroads. As the crow flies is just an advertising gimmick. The idea that there wouldn't be a big zig or a big zag, but that you would go basically from the north to the south with just a little bit of a zigzag. So, of course, Pensacola to Chicago was point A and point B for the trip, but Chicago to Pensacola was what they were trying to advertise. If you're not familiar with boosterism, there are people who, at least in their public personas, are completely driven by the idea of pushing forward the good points of a thing in which they're either financially or emotionally invested. So all of these people that were associated with this Pensacola to Chicago pathfinding trip were boosters. And they were kind of on the nuts end of boosters, super fandom. They were willing to put their physical bodies where their mouths were, so to speak. This was dangerous.
All these multifaceted angles pointed at one main objective, getting into the American Automobile Association, or the AAA for short, Blue Book. Dr. Olaf succinctly explained why such an objective was significant.
The AAA Blue Book was considered to be the Bible of long-distance travel.
As Dr. Olaf mentioned before, the four men drove on roads we would not even walk on and accomplished the 1,149-mile Pensacola to Chicago pathfinding trip on September 12, 1911, in an impressive total runtime of 76 hours across 9 days with, as Dr. Kennedy bragged, quote, Pensacola air in the tires, end quote. The immediate effects of this pathfinding trip on Pensacola's tourism sector was not apparent. However, getting into the AAA Blue Book was achieved in the next year's edition, and, as Dr. Olaf described, that could have facilitated an influx of tourists to Pensacola.
The one thing that did happen that could have added to the influx in a positive way was that the AAA Blue Book accepted the route description provided by Kennedy and Frank Mays as the route from Birmingham through Andalusia down to Pensacola.
The broader legacy of this trip would far outlive the four men that took on this automobile adventure. As Dr. Olaf wrote in the final sentence of his journal article, quote, the result was neither an all-weather road nor a road as straight as the crow flies, but the scouts, the four men, laid the foundation for an automotive alternative to riding the Louisville and Nashville Railroad for northerner tourists who, someday, would vacation on the Gulf, end quote. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcast producer at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Holly Baker, Connie Lester, and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.